Okay, well, the topic of the event here today is depression. Are we on the brink? Are we at a turning point? I think it's important, if we're going to say we're on the brink of depression, to understand a little bit better what depression is. Are we on the brink of depression? I would say no, not yet. Are we in a depression, rather? I'd say no, not yet. Are we on the brink of one? Could very well be. We'll know in about a year, I believe, if the current solutions proposed by the Obama administration do not work. I think we'll be very close to transitioning to something like that in 2010. It's interesting that there isn't much unanimity among economists about what is a depression, simply that it's much worse than a recession. It's amazing, after decades of debating and trying to understand, like the Great Depression of the 30s, they still don't have anything near agreement as to what a depression is. It's amazing. They don't even have an agreement on what a recession is. You know, in the vernacular, we understand recession as two consecutive quarters of GDP decline, but that's not the real definition of recession. The real definition is provided by the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is simply a significant decline in production, employment, and other variables, and they determine what that is. So here we got, you know, even these 10,000 economists who couldn't predict what was going on in terms of the current crisis, maybe about 10 of them did, you can't even come to agreement on what's a depression and what's a recession. We do know that what we're in now is certainly not a normal recession. Certainly something much, much more severe, but not really yet a depression. If you look at the depression in the 30s, for example, stock prices dropped 90%. Wholesale prices dropped 60%. Other prices dropped maybe 50%. Unemployment was officially recorded as 25%. However, it's pretty clear that unemployment level was even worse than 25% because that only represents industrial labor. Didn't include farm labor. If you add farm labor at the time, we're probably somewhere between 30% and 40% unemployment rate. So obviously, in a whole number of indicators, the Great Depression was far worse than where we are now. But obviously, in terms of comparison to the nine recessions since 1945, what we have now is far more severe. Some people call this a Great Recession or a Near Depression. If you read the business press and some of the commentators, Krugman and Stiglitz and others, but they don't go very far in trying to describe or explain what they mean by that. It just kind of means it's worse than a recession and not as bad as a depression. I think it's important that we understand how this current downturn is similar and different from both recessions and depressions. If we don't understand the similarities and differences, we're not going to be able to understand where this is going. I have coined the term epic recession. However, I have bothered to describe what that means in a series of articles in Z Magazine over the past year. And epic recession is really not something quite unique. We kind of think, well, this is the first time we've had something that's worse than a recession and not yet a depression. Not true. We've had these events before, these sort of midway events. If you look at Japan in the 1990s, that would be an epic recession. I believe if you look at 1929-30, that first phase of the Depression should be properly described as an epic recession. If you talk to the people then, and there's a lot of articles written in the press and so forth, no one believed they were in the Depression at that time. At that time, what they thought the Depression was 1920-21, which was far worse than 1929-30. And like 1920-21, everyone thought in 2029-30 that if they just wait it out, it will recover on its own, which it did in 2021, much worse than 2930. And you had a view that was described as liquidationists. In other words, let's not do anything. The result of the stock market crash is the speculation of the 1920s, and it will. We got to have some deflation to work off the assets, and it will recover on its own. Sound familiar to some views being expressed today? Yeah, there's a similarity there. Epic recession, I believe, does not evolve from a recession. They are quite different animals. So what we got now is something quite different than post-war recessions. It may evolve into a depression, but not guaranteed so. It may not. We have examples of epic recessions that have not evolved into depression. So it's important to know what are the conditions by which something like we have now may or may not evolve into a depression. Kind of important to understand and predict the future, right? Certainly what we have now is a very unstable hybrid kind of condition. If you look at it, it has some of the characteristics of depression, some of a recession, but neither full-blown either. Very unstable, hybrid kind of a condition that is tends to evolve one way or the other to be contained or to evolve into a depression. The point is, if what we have now is quite different, we need to understand how and why it is different if we want to know where we may be going in terms of evolution of the crisis. I have a particular critique I have of many of the writers out there, including economists and business pundits and people like Krugman and Stiglitz and others who are moving, interestingly, more to the left almost every day. But, you know, it's an empirical narrative description of the present. There's not much of an analysis of the past. There's not much of an attempt theoretically to understand how we are where we are, what's different about this, and why it may be evolving in a certain direction or not. It's kind of like, you know, the American muckraking tradition, but without much of a theoretical historical understanding. Right? Certainly, this is not unique. This is certainly not a crisis caused by the subprime market. That was just one early symptom. It's not even a crisis caused by a long-term financial deregulation that's gone on since the 80s, or the S&L crisis in the 80s, or the junk bond crisis. Not even a consequence of the reorganization, restructuring of capital that occurred in 1978 to 88, I believe. If you look at what's happening now, the key characteristic of it is that what we have is an overlap of financial cycles and real cycles. Okay, if you look at all true depressions, we had a true depression in the 1830s, 1870s, 1890s, and then, of course, in the 1930s. In all these cases, what you had was a excess of speculative investment, particularly in land and housing of various kinds. In the 1830s, it was over-speculation in canal building. In the 1870s, it was railroads. 1890s, it was the merger movement, industrial merger movement. And then in the 1920s, it was both farm mortgage expansion, most of the commercial building expansion. You see a lot of it in this city was built in the 1920s, and housing expansion. People were buying houses at a very large rate. So we have a speculative excess going on. We have a real economic boom that occurs, but then we have banks and financial institutions and new kinds of institutions who attempt to speculate on the real economic growth and create different kind of financial instruments that they sell on top of the real investment. And what happens is that gets out of hand and continues to expand when the real economy then begins to slow down. So you have an imbalance between speculative and non-speculative investment, and the asset price explosion that occurs when you have speculative investment comes to an abrupt end. And then you have a collapse in asset prices, whether they're called housing prices here or whether they're called different forms of speculative investment in the 1920s, and then you're off and running in a spiral effect. The real economy, in other words, precipitates the crisis, but then the financial crisis feeds back on the real economy and exacerbates the economic downturn, right? Asset price booms turn into busts. You have price deflation. You then get credit crunches. Credit crunches cause the real economy to slow down. Interest rates, banks won't loan. Interest rates rise. You have banking failures. Then it spills over into the real economy, and you have a increasing string of defaults in non-financial corporations. GM is a good example of what's going on now in the non-financial sector. Okay. If you look at the 1930s, what are some of the myths about the 1930s, I think, that are important to clarify? First of all, it was not just one single event that occurred with the stock market crash. As I said, the real economy precipitated it. Stock market crash just exacerbated it. And then all of the kinds of asset prices began to collapse. By the way, housing prices in the 1930s continued to collapse until 1935. It went on for more than 5 years. And we talked about the stock market falling 90% and so forth. There's really four periods in the Depression. The first is the 1929-30 period, which is called, as I call, the Epic Recession. Could go either way. And that period culminates in the first banking crisis. From 1929 to 34, you have four banking crises that occur in sequence. In between, you have increasing defaults on the part of consumers and non-financial corporations, which in turn feed back and cause the financial crisis, the next banking crisis. Well, we've had our first banking crisis here last fall. We had the banking panic of 2008, and banks froze up, banks went on strike and stopped the lending. Okay? That's the first crisis. Now it's feeding back into the real economy, and it's causing a series of defaults. Standard & Poor's, for example, estimates that the corporate default rate is going to rise from 5 to 15% over the course of this year. You're going to have a lot of non-financial corporations going under. You're going to go to the mall, see a lot of empty stores. You're going to see a lot of car dealers out of business and so forth. Now, those losses feed back into the financial system and cause further decline in assets and further problems on bank balance sheets. And a further collapse and a second round of financial crisis. I think the second round is coming in 2010. And the key here is going to be the two new subprime bombs that are developing in the economy. One is commercial property, which is following the same track as residential housing. And the other is what's called consumer credit, auto loans, credit card loans, student loans, and so forth. The default rates are rising and will continue to rise dramatically. You may have heard about the credit card defaults rising. Well, we're just at the beginning of that. Should those occur over the course of the next year, it will cause further losses in the financial system and another round of asset price collapses. The other myth is that the New Deal ended the Great Depression. It did not end the Great Depression. The New Deal was really 35 to 37. You know, the real depression was 29 to 34. The New Deal comes along and it stabilizes the depression, but it does not end the depression, okay? Only stabilizes it. And as soon as it stabilized it, they started dismantling it. Okay, business and Republican interests start putting pressure on FDR. And in 37, he starts dismantling the whole process, and we go back into a depression in 38, and we have stagnation until 1940, and that was the fourth phase of the depression, the stagnation phase. We don't recover from the depression until 1942, okay, which brings us to the next myth, and that is World War II ended the depression. Now, that's the hardest one to argue. All right, but think of it this way, right? In 1929, the government spent 3% of gross domestic product. Government was hardly a force. In 1935, it was up to 20%. 20% government spending stabilized, did not recover from the Depression. In 1942, however, it was 40% GDP, and in 44, 70% of GDP. Now, what do we mean when we say government spending? Well, we mean two things during the Second World War. One, you know, government spending on bullets and tanks and guns and so forth is one form. But the other form, very important form, was a huge amount of spending on public investment by the government. Right? Now, if you take away the spending on guns and bombs and so forth in 1945, you would return the economy right back where it was. Right? But what was really important about the spending was the creation and the building by the federal government of all kind of factories and plants and equipment and so forth. It renovated the taxpayer. The federal government renovated the whole industrial base of the United States at taxpayer expense. That's public investment. Okay. And the other big thing about World War II was a major shift in income from capital to labor as a result of the tax structure and as a result of workers working all kind of overtime, earning all kind of income and so forth. In other words, in 1929, the wealthiest 1% of households had 22% of all income in the United States. By 1945, they had 8%. 8%. The income had shifted. And by the way, that 8% remained pretty constant until the late 1970s, and then it started escalating again, and today we're right back up to 22%. And by the way, we're right back into a financial crisis and instability and so forth like we had in 29. So there's a relationship between income distribution and these crises that are going on. So in World War II, it was public investment in plant and equipment. End of World War II, you have all this state-of-the-art plant and equipment, and you have all the income to spend, and the economy took off. Of course, also exports, Marshall Plan, and so forth played a role. But it was primarily these two developments during World War II, which means, very interestingly, if we are on the verge of another depression, and if we turn the corner into one next year, the only way to get out of it is really for public investment to increase to 40%, I believe. We're only at 20% now. We're going to have a much more massive increase in public investment and public-generated jobs creation. One of my main criticisms of the Obama bill, that $787 billion bill, was not a jobs bill. We have 20 million unemployed by the end of this year. We're already at 15 million when properly calculated. Okay? A major, major problem with consumption when you have that many unemployed. The Obama stimulus bill only provides for $180 billion spending in this year, only $27 billion on jobs, and he's only claiming that he will create or save 3.5 million jobs in 2 years. We will not get out of this crisis unless we have a massive government job spending bill and unless we do something about the housing price collapse, the housing industry. The Obama program does not do anything, essentially, about the whole housing price collapse except to subsidize new home builders, mortgage servicers, and the lenders to the tune of $1 trillion in order to bring down in mortgage interest rates 1%. And then another $1 trillion to buy up the bad assets that exist in the banks and the shadow banking system. That's not going to work either. That's called the PIP and the TELF. Neither of those two programs are going to work for this reason. They keep talking about all the bad assets. They got to give the bad assets off the bank's balance books in order to get them to lend, right? Well, the problem is bad assets come in two forms. One's bad mortgage loans, and the other is bad securitized loans. Bad mortgage loans, according to corporate accounting, you can keep them on your books at the full value at which you bought them. In other words, at 98% is what they're saying. Those mortgage loans may be worth 50%, but they're holding them on their books at 98%. And the whole problem is, how do you get the banks to sell those bad loans? Once they sell them at 50%, they got to register a 50% markdown. Okay. They don't want to do it. They're holding the bad assets on their books valued way above what they really are at a market level price. Now flip that around, and you've got the bad securitized assets. Securitized, or, you know, when they chop things up, subprimes and student loans, and they throw them in a financial salad bowl, and they say, okay, this is a CDO, called collateralized debt obligations. Well, those have to be valued at market price until last week. And market price, they call it mark-to-market, is really about, on the average, 10 cents on the dollar. Well, the banks would like to get rid of those, but the investors don't want to buy them. They're virtually worthless. So what you got is the federal government coming in and saying, we will subsidize the market to create a market to buy these bad loans and bad securitized assets, and we will pay the difference to create a market. Okay. The problem is, no, very few people are going for it. Okay. Either TELF or the PIP are not working. And if neither of them work, then we have almost for sure a collapse in consumer credit markets and the commercial property markets before the end of the year. Two new subprime bombs that I was talking about. Okay, they were talking about nationalizing the banks up until the new program came out, and then they quashed that whole discussion, right? Once this fails, that's going to be back on the agenda in discussion. But what do we mean by nationalization? Greenspan and the Wall Street Journal editorialists mean subsidize the banks, okay? That's what they mean by nationalization. It's time, though, for those on the left to propose a different kind of nationalization. By the way, if you read the Krugman and Stiglitz and all those, you know, they're talking of some variant of buying up the bad assets, a la Sweden, Aggregator Bank, and so forth, right? There really is no proposal for a true nationalization of the banking system. In some of my proposals, alternative program, also in Z Magazine's issue in March, I proposed how we would nationalize in a practical step-by-step basis, nationalize at least the residential mortgage market and the small business property market as a start. Then you would have to figure out how to truly nationalize these consumer credit markets that aren't going to be covered. You know, auto loans, student loans, and so forth. We could do that through the credit unions. We could have a step-by-step nationalization of the banking system if we really wanted to propose it. Okay. Let me conclude with just a few statements about where I think we are in terms of on the left here, and that is we don't really understand. We're not really looking at our past and what actually happened. We're operating on a lot of myths and misunderstandings as to what actually happened. New Deal, FDR, the whole thing, okay? And secondly, we are not really talking about program in the future. You know, we are caught in this descriptive narrative, empirical analysis of the present. And, you know, a lot of people are writing about that, and you can read that in the business press. You know, Nouriel Roubini and Willem Duder and all these guys, they're describing what's going on. But the task now is really to describe how do we get beyond this and get beyond this in a way that benefits the majority of the nation and not the few, wealthy investors and capitalists and bankers. Right? We're short on program. However, I would say in California now, the Central Labor Councils, Trade Union Central Labor Councils are holding, starting next month, a teach-in, and all the labor councils in the Bay Area have endorsed this. This is a labor event, which they hope then to bring to the rest of the country, and then maybe have some demonstrations and so forth, on a labor program for dealing with this crisis. You know, single payer, nationalize, the banking system and so forth. This is where we need to go. We need to start talking about pragmatic reform, immediate reforms, intermediate reforms, and a vision of the future. All three are important, as well as to better understand our past in order to understand where to go in the future. We got to get out of this empirical swamp that we're stuck in, just talking about what's happening right now. Okay, thanks.
Switch in the program. Naomi Prinz is going to go next. Naomi's going to talk about how Wall Street practices that led to the crisis were like those that led to the Great Depression, only on steroids, and the rest. Naomi Prinz, and then Michael Hudson, then Hillel Tigtin. And by the end of it, we will have a lot of time for discussion from all of you.
Hi. I actually want to start a little bit where Jack left off, and then sort of work backwards and then forwards. The program, the $787 billion stimulus program that was put forth by Obama on one side, and the $12.7 trillion of money, can you guys hear me? Okay. $12.7 trillion of money, not the $1 trillion a few weeks ago that's going into this public-private partnership program, which basically says to the same hedge funds and banks that screwed up the financial system that they themselves created, we're going to lend you 6-to-1 on your money. We're going to up to $1 trillion. I'm not talking about, there's $12.7 trillion worth of money that has come between the Treasury Department, the Federal Reserve, and rebacking the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which is one of the good things that came out of the New Deal and got itself started in 1935 to back regular normal people deposits in banks for banks that only dealt primarily with loans and deposits. So the New Deal basically looked at an environment where banks had speculated, where there was a 90% decline in the stock market over 3 years with a lot of fits and starts. And back then the news was, okay, it's up, it's down, we're better, we're not better, et cetera, which is very similar to today. The last 6 weeks we have been told, well, it actually happened, the Dow's been up. Everything's kind of okay. Wells Fargo, one of the biggest banks in the country, is coming in with profits all of a sudden, which after you've been given $25 billion from the government, a whole lot of cheap loan, I make a profit on stuff too. Citigroup is making a profit. Now, all of a sudden, we're lending again. But if you actually look beneath the surface, you're not making a profit if what you're making is $2.1 billion, for example, if you're Citigroup, yet you've been given $326 billion in various ways through the government. That's like, yeah. So you look at where money has gone, and yes, it's today, and yes, it's current, but $787 billion, it's not with a T, to something that could be critiqued as a program that works for individual people. And then you have $12.7 trillion that's going to the banking system. That's not going to help anything. That's just basically sucking up money. And the thing is, the banking system isn't just getting money from the Treasury. By getting money from the Federal Reserve, which is the bulk of the money that's going into the banking system, it's $8 trillion of those dollars, is being given in basically cheap loans. It's being given at 0 to 0.25% interest rates. You guys can't get a loan for 0% interest rates. So if the government is giving money to the banking system at 0 to 0.25% and even if the banks are lending you money at 5% or 6%, they're making a whole lot of money subsidized by the government. That's different from during the Great Depression, where you didn't have that kind of money going into the banking system. The banking system, I believe, this is where I differ a little bit from Jack, although I think we got to the same conclusion, drove this situation. It drove it not because the housing market was going up and it looked at an opportunity. It drove it, the banking system, and Wall Street drove this situation because they had nothing else to do. Okay? It was 2001, 2002. Enron had happened. WorldCom had happened. We were in a recession. There was a tremendous lack of confidence, and rightly so, in the corporate system. And there was a lot of corporate bankruptcies. There was a second period in terms of the level of corporate bankruptcies. There was no investment in corporations. And as you probably all know, the Fed reacted to this and a combination of a reaction to 9/11 by decreasing interest rates from 6.5% to down to 1.75%. What did that mean? That meant there was a lot of cheap money in the market. That meant banks couldn't make as much money as they were making when rates were higher. They basically had money to give. That's kind of when subprime lending started going, but not because banks were trying to be nice and find products that people needed and opening the world to, you know, this other class of people who couldn't otherwise afford housing, which is how even in 05 and 06 and 07 this was discussed in Washington, but just because they needed something else to bet on. They needed something else to securitize, to stuff into more complex securitizations, and to borrow again. So what happened was we had a little bit of bump in subprime. Banks had nothing else to really do, so they decided, and when I say banks, I mean J.P. Morgan's investment side. I mean Goldman Sachs. I mean Morgan Stanley. I mean the banks that could basically drive securitization. Not so much from Washington, but from Wall Street. And what they said was, you know what, we're going to securitize subprime. We're going to securitize what we securitized, as Jack mentioned. We're going to come up with all sorts of names, and we're going to leverage the system. And what leveraging the system meant, and we leveraged it a whole lot more in the last few years and went into the period before the Great Depression, is we're going to basically take a loan, and we're going to leverage it from being a loan to being in about 10 different securities. We're not going to securitize it once. We're not going to take one package of loans and make one package of securities. We're going to take those securities and we're going to repackage them, and so on and so forth. And the numbers that worked out was that there was $1.4 trillion worth of subprime loans made to people. regular homeowners. Some of them maybe shouldn't have been made. Many of them were a second loan on the same house, a home equity loan on the same house. So many of them were already multiple loans on the same individual home. But beyond that, there was only 1.4 trillion of them. That was a 300% increase from what there had been before the period between 2002 to 2007. But that's all there was. The government has now spent $12.7 trillion fixing it, and it's not fixed. So the difference that we have still yet to go through is that the $1.4 trillion became $14 trillion worth of securitized product. It was multiplied by 10. The $14 trillion, which doesn't get discussed by Krugman and the like, became, I believe, something like $140 trillion. Why? Because of leverage in the system. In the Great Depression, banks weren't leveraged to the extent that they became leveraged in this period. Worse than that, investment banks weren't leveraged to the same extent. You didn't have hedge funds being leveraged to the same extent. In 2004, as the subprime market was in the home loans was increasing and securitization by the banks was increasing, the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, which is supposed to regulate the financial system and protect the public, or that was what it was said to be doing as part of the New Deal when it came out, turned around and said to investment banks who had been lobbying for this for 4 years, the head lobby for this was Hank Paulson, who was the CEO of Goldman Sachs at the time this leverage law was changed in 2004, had been lobbying since February 2000 in front of Congress, became the Treasury Secretary that doled out money to Goldman Sachs afterwards, basically said, you know what, investment banks can't compete with regular banks. Goldman Sachs cannot compete with Bank of America. So you know what, we need to be able to leverage what we have more. Instead of leveraging what we have 12 to 1, which was the rule, we would like to be able to almost triple that to 30 to 1. Which meant that if it had $1 trillion worth of assets, it could basically create $30 trillion in terms of what it could borrow for its books. So now you have $1 trillion of assets underlying $30 trillion of nothing. And the nothing only had value if you could sell it to someone. And that's what happened. That's where the banking system was able to continue to leverage itself beyond its capacity to absorb its own risk. And when that all collapsed, is effectively when, what Jack was talking about it in 08, but really leading up to that, we had a collapse in the banking system. I believe this is a banking depression. I believe the first depression, the Great Depression, as much as it was dire for the general economy because of the relationship between who is controlling the money and who is basically working on the other side of that equation, is what we have now. We've got a bank-led depression. The banks are effectively over-leveraged. Without the government, most of them could not survive. A couple of the investment banks, i.e. Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, both had to declare bankruptcy. But even in their declaration of bankruptcy, unlike in situations where if a person goes bankrupt, the government does not step in and say, hey, you know what, sorry, you had some health concerns, your medical expenses were too high, you lost your house, you know, here's a couple hundred grand to like tide you over. What happened was when Bear Stearns went bankrupt because it had leveraged or borrowed more than it had collateral to pay, the Federal Reserve, who wasn't allowed to give money to Bear Stearns because it is not, as part of a Bank Holding Company Act, which was in 1956 and other acts, the Federal Reserve was not allowed to back investment banks. So what it did was it said, hey, J.P. Morgan, we're going to loan the money to you and you give it to Bear Stearns, which is what the Fed effectively did. It then went into the Fed's balance sheet, into the Fed's book, because now it was part of J.P. Morgan, and J.P. Morgan was under the jurisdiction of the bank, of the Fed. The Fed did the same thing in September when Lehman Brothers was about to fall apart. It said, we can't lend you money. You're going bankrupt. You know, you owe money to a lot of banks. So rather than give you the money, which we cannot do, we're going to give it to J.P. Morgan. So what the Fed did was it put out an $138 billion loan, which sounds like nothing out of all these trillions, but they weren't allowed to do it under their own mandates. So, and they let J.P. Morgan give the money to Lehman so that Lehman could basically pay off its banks. So Lehman could pay off companies like Goldman or Morgan Stanley or whomever else we don't know because the information isn't disclosed. I call the Fed on a regular basis to try to get that one number verified. I'm like, there's this number that showed up. You know, where did that go? It's not on J.P. Morgan's books. It's somewhere in Lehman Brothers' bankruptcy reports. But the lack of transparency in the system today supersedes a lot of what happened back in the Great Depression simply because the numbers are so much more massive. And as there continues to be trillions of dollars spent on helping the banking system remain solvent, whether that is by buying its bad assets as these bad bank ideas are thrown around, which is a really dumb idea. It was always a dumb idea. You don't buy assets that have no value, and you certainly don't lend money to private companies to buy the assets that have no value. I mean, no one would do that in real life. You would not lend money to someone that you know is a bad bet. But the thing is, it's not the Fed's money. And it's not really the Treasury's money. It's not an individual money. It's kind of our money. And it's being used to clean up a system without looking at how to change the system. And what resulted, and even if it took a while out of the Great Depression and out of the New Deal, was a movement, a legislation, and an act to make the banking system more transparent. What had resulted in the stock market crash in 1929 and in the years of depression that followed was banks gone amok. Yes, there were issues and unemployment rose significantly and the housing market back then got ahead of itself and all those things happened, but the crash, the money that was depleted from the system that then fell on top of everybody else and made everything a whole lot worse was because of the banking system. It borrowed then beyond its capacity. But in this situation, it borrowed far more beyond its capacity to back itself. And we had to basically pony up a whole lot more to try and fix it. And we're nowhere near fixing it, and we're nowhere near the solution that was taken back in 1933, which was to segment the banking system into areas that the government does back and areas that they don't. So there's none of this will back Bear Stearns by giving money to J.P. Morgan. There's none of this will give Merrill Lynch, which was a mess of an investment bank, about to fall apart in the fall of 08, given to Bank of America with the guarantee from the government to back its losses. I mean, that kind of thing did not happen back in the 30s. So there was a situation where at least it wasn't, the system wasn't made worse by the intervention of the government. And in this situation, what the government has done is effectively obliterated rules. The Fed has given money where it feels it can by going through middle parties, which are in the banking system. It has allowed various banks to become, speculative banks to become under the jurisdiction of the government. Goldman Sachs has no intention of dealing with any of you. And you may not want to deal with Goldman Sachs, but the point is they became a bank holding company, which effectively gives them the ability to get money from the FDIC, which was created back in 1935 to help people's deposits and to back them, not to back corporate deposits and institutional deposits. And they got $28 billion worth of just loans from the FDIC, as if they were a bank, which they are not. That kind of thing wasn't going on back then. So the idea of how the government has been dealing with the situation, particularly the Fed, but also the Treasury, and all the situational monies that have been thrown out into the banking system, and the rules that have been collapsed, the idea that a Goldman Sachs can become a bank in 5 days, the idea that Morgan Stanley can do the same thing, the idea that in order to help Lehman Brothers pay Goldman Sachs for losses Goldman Sachs might have, the money is lent to J.P. Morgan just because it's there. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that wasn't going on. So rather than stepping back and saying, you know what, the system doesn't work and we're making it worse, we're making more complex banks that we don't understand bigger. You know, we should learn from history. We should go back and do one thing that, even though it was attacked from the moment it was put forth, the idea of the Glass-Steagall Act, which basically said we separate the two kinds of banks that we have. We separate the ones that are going to speculate and leverage, and at the time it was a whole lot less than it is today, from the ones that deal with people's deposits and regular loans. And the speculative part doesn't get government backing. It just doesn't. They are on their own. The consumer part, yes, it can have government backing because it's dealing with the public. And if it's going to get public funds, it makes sense that it could be backed by a government that gets its funds from the public. So it made sense. We're nowhere near that. That is not the remotest conversation going on, except by about one senator in Congress that actually seriously is looking at restructuring the banking industry instead of talking about how to perhaps regulate around it, even though there's a lack of understanding as to how it actually accumulated $140 trillion worth of nothing out of $1.4 trillion of subprime loans. If it was just the loans, we could have paid $1.4 trillion to every subprime borrower and we'd be done. We're nowhere near done. And opening up to a trillion here for a fund and a trillion there for a bailout and a trillion there for a set of loans that aren't even on the books of the Fed, or are, but you have to kind of look around and they won't really answer questions about them, is really not a way to run an economy, and it's really not a way to run a government. And so I think going back, we can learn from the segregation of the banking system. We can deleverage the banking system, not because the banking system wants to, not under their rules, but under rules that are legislated, that are actual acts, that are actual congressional movements that actually tame the system. Not deal with what we have and try to fix it, but restructure it. And that's the thing that's really missing in the current debates, and that's why I think this is going to get a lot worse. Way before it gets any better, and I don't think that what's going to happen after this period of it getting worse, we are going to be in a better position. I think, if anything, we'll be at a sort of plateau that will go down further because we're not doing the right things to actually tame a system that basically screwed itself and then everybody else in the process, but in that and afterwards has gotten bailed out for it. And not even bailed out to be stable, just bailed out to be handed money to continue to do what it's doing.
Thank you, Naomi Freeman. You can look for her book that's coming out in September, and it's called, it's called It Takes... I can't seem to find it right here.
It takes a pillage.
Behind the bonuses, bailout, and backroom deal from Wall Street to Washington. Now we're going to have Michael Hudson. And Michael Hudson was the chief economic advisor to Dennis Kucinich. He is the president of the Institute for the Study for Long-Term Economic Trends. Maybe we should ask him what he's telling Kucinich today. But in another panel that I was privileged to have Michael with, he began to talk about, you know, now what we hear is the world of government sacks and the question of whether or not the banks have privatized the government and the nature of the crisis.
I think that Naomi has described the debt leveraging that's going on as clearly and succinctly as it can be done. I think the problem for a lot of socialists and left audience is that you almost have to work in the field and follow the economic news every day in order to almost visualize the kind of ripoff that she's been describing and how it actually works. America has created the equivalent of what happened when the railroad barons were created in the mid-19th century. This is a new group of kleptocrats. I think you should think of Obama as the American Yeltsin, who's given away to his campaign contributors in exchange for getting the position of president. I wonder if you can hear me better this way. Can you hear me if I talk this way?
No, you can't.
Okay, have to. Sorry, it's every little millimeter has a meaning all its own with a different. You really have to realize that what's been created in the $13 trillion giveaway that she said, this is a new group of ruling families and power elite that is going to be dominating American society for the next century. These are the new families, and it is amazing that all of this giveaway has been to bail out creditors without any relief for debtors whatsoever. That's the amazing thing. As she said, a little over $1 trillion would have solved the whole subprime problem. So when you give away $12 trillion and say there's $100 trillion to come or whatever it takes, you know that it's not the subprime problem and that it's not just a few poor borrowers. The situation, I want to say, is much worse than what Mr. Rasmus has described. Let me describe the TARF giveaway, and I've done this on Counterpunch and I've done it on Global Research. The FDIC and the Treasury are putting up 85% of the amount of money for what essentially are junk mortgages. We know that many of the mortgages given were fraud. We know that the idea of nationalizing the financial system has really been essentially when 11 state attorney generals brought fraudulent claims of fraud against Citibank, Wachovia, Countrywide, Bank of America. We know that these were empty mortgages, fraudulent mortgages, and Bush said, we're going to centralize all under a 1864 clause in the National Bank Act, pact during the Civil War. We're going to centralize and have Washington coordinate everything with a single regulator. He appointed a single regulator. Mr. Geithner came before Congress and said, I'm not a regulator. Everything, you get to keep everything. Now, that means that these banks are with a lot of mortgages that are worth from 0 to 10 cents on the dollar. Now, they can, and there was a discussion in Congress over how the bailout will work. Now, they can put up 15, let's say $15 million on a $100 million mortgage. The government puts in $85 million with no recourse, so Citibank can start its own investment company, buy its own junk mortgages that are worth zero, and instead of getting zero, it gets $85 million from the government instead of half and half. So the situation's much worse than half and half. It's a pure giveaway, and in the Senate and House, this was brought up, and the government said, well, we hope the financial sector behaves fairly. But the fact is, we're dealing with a criminalized sector. And by criminalized, I mean they've stolen it fair and square, but they've put their own people in office as self-regulators. That's what the free market is. A free market today, to Obama and the Republicans, is a market free of law enforcement, free of government regulation, free of any constraint on the kleptocrats, to essentially reduce the entire nation to paying as much money as it takes for the government to make the financial sector whole on fictitious capital. So it's almost like you're turning the economy into science fiction. You make fictitious capital real by the Treasury printing bonds that ultimately will have to be taxed and turned over to the banks in exchange for their junk mortgages. This is the cash for trash trade-off. Now, in terms of the topic of the panel, what does an economy do about this? I don't see any recovery in sight, and I speak to a lot of Wall Street investors, and they don't see any recovery in sight either. Nobody can say how to get out of this. Every recovery in America since World War II has started from a higher and higher level of debt. And every business upswing throughout history has culminated in a crisis. There's a write-down of debt. There's bankruptcy. You wipe out the debt, and then at least you begin to rise again. That hasn't happened in this case. No write-down of debt, and in fact, the government is now in the position of being a creditor against largely fictitious debts, debts which are far beyond the ability of people to pay. And I want to say this is a worldwide phenomenon. This is not only the U.S. I just got back from Iceland, and in Iceland, the banks say, we need a thriving financial system, so to make sure that we have the money to thrive, in addition to your paying the mortgage rates of 6%, we've indexed the loans to the rate of depreciation in the currency. Iceland was run by four feudal families that own half the land. They have borrowed $500,000 for every Icelandic citizen, about $30 trillion. Nobody knows how much debt it owes because it's so much debt that England has placed Iceland on the terrorist list so that for the British ice save, they can grab all of the Icelandic deposits and things all over the world. And here is a country with no army, not even a NATO base, and they're accused of being terrorists. And they have to pay over and above the mortgage 18% consumer price index index on that. Half the Icelanders are going to lose their houses this year. In a country of 300,000 people, about half the population is going to have to emigrate, presumably to Ireland, to make up for all the Latvians who've gone back when the Irish upswing has stopped. The whole world is unable to pay its debts. In Europe, you have the post-Soviet economies that for the last 15 years have imported almost all of their consumer goods and investment goods, and they've paid for their imports by borrowing mortgage credit in foreign currency, because at least after communism, they had all this housing free of debt, all this public infrastructure free of debt. So they borrowed in foreign currency up to the limit. And now the property in the Baltic states is as high priced as it is in Berlin and Germany, and there's no more real estate bubble there. Without a real estate bubble, there's no foreign exchange coming in to finance the consumer spending and business spending, so there's an absolute stop. There were riots 2 weeks ago when the IMF said it was going to make loans to Latvia. The loans to Latvia were to repay the Swedish banks that made the bad real estate debts. They cut at the country with the lowest living standards in Western Europe, 10%, by saying the wages will have to go down by at least 30%, lifespans will have to shorten by 20 years per person, and much more of the population will have to die quickly in order to pay the Swedish banks for the bad loans that they've made. So if you think things are bad here, this is the model for where we're going. There is no other model that anybody can see to be able to pay debts that can't be paid. Well, in a situation like this, the basic principle is a debt that can't be paid won't be. The question is, in what way are the debts not going to be paid? Are they going to be paid by mass foreclosures and a transfer of property from debtors to creditors, or will they be paid in the way that people had expected them to be paid in the past, by wiping out the bad debts? The Obama administration is absolutely set on following the Bush administration, almost as if it's the Bush 3 administration, in saying that the debts must be paid, we're not going to write them down. By no coincidence, his largest campaign contributors were the financial sector. So what happens in debt deflation? You have the foreclosures, you have economic polarization, you have a tax shift. The banks have basically been declared tax write-offs for the next generation because of all of their mergers. When a good bank takes a bad bank, it's given a tax loss carry forward that will essentially make the financial sector tax exempt. Property, commercial real estate in this country has hardly paid any income tax since World War II because it can treat interest as tax deductible expense and pretend that the buildings are depreciating in value even when property prices are going up. So you're having a huge tax shift. You're having a squeeze on state and local budgets, including here in New York. I had to wait 15 minutes for the subway train to come today. The property prices are plunging here, and the wealthy people are simply not paying. So what you're having is the cities unable to finance their usual amount of spending. There's already default on the statements that they intend to default on the pensions that they've negotiated, and the state and local pension plans are way under. In yesterday's Financial Times, you had Bush's representative on the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which the government insurance agency for the corporate pension plans, write what he suggests should be the Obama plan, and I'm sure it is. He says, corporations are not going to be able to pay the banks if they also have to pay their labor. You have to remember that we're talking about contractual arrangements here. Only a contract to the bank is now legal. He suggests that they declare all contractual promises to labor illegal and nullified. He proposes to nullify all corporate pension obligations so that they will return to solvency and can afford to employ labor again. He said labor unions should all vote for this because, after all, their pension funds are invested in stocks and they're capitalists in miniature. So the question is, what is their identity going to be? He says that the good news is that General Motors is going bankrupt in a few months, and that will wipe out the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. And despite the $12 trillion that Nomi's talked about for the banks, the one insurance company, and despite the $185 billion to AIG, the one insurance company the government did not rescue was the PBGC, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation.
You got 3 to 5 minutes.
Oh, okay. Well, work fairly fast. So I'm going to try to summarize on debt deflation. You're having residential real estate prices go down, and as Nomi said, why on earth would anybody lend to somebody already where the mortgage is larger than the property? 25% of American residential homes are the mortgage is larger than their market price, so that's negative equity. There's no way they'll borrow. Newspapers have applauded the rise in saving rates, saying finally people are saving again. It was 0%. There's more saving in the last few years at 0% than there has ever been in the American economy. Unfortunately, all the saving is by the wealthiest 10%, and it's lent out to the bottom 90%. So this is a wash. This is zero on national income accounting. Now, finally, the bottom 90% are repaying. Three-quarters of this 5%, 3.5%, is the repayment in credit card debt by people who've had their credit card limits limited by the companies. So instead of really saving, what this is working down the debts that they've been loaded down during the upswing when Alan Greenspan said, the way to get rich is to run into debt, turn over all the income to the banks, and you'll get rich in no time off the asset price inflation that I'm financing. So essentially, the people thought they were getting rich by going into debt. This is historically unique. You're also having commercial property, as you've probably seen, plunging in price. The malls, the mall company went bankrupt a few days ago, office buildings. I said the corporate pension plans, if the corporations live to their contractual agreement to contribute to the pension plans, they're not going to have any profits this year. And without profits, there's not going to be a stock market upswing. The state and local groups are broken. So that basically is the position that they're in. Where does this leave Wall Street and the capitalists? They're in the same position that the Central Bank of China is in. They have all these dollars that they've been given. What on earth are they going to do with it? Nobody I know can figure out how to preserve. If you're a billionaire in America, you have a real problem. How are you going to preserve what you've stolen? How are you going to keep it without losing it? And it's very difficult to figure out. Nobody can figure out a way. You're not going to put it into real estate. You can't buy gold. China tried to diversify out of the euro out of the dollar into the euro and sterling and lost its shirts, because the one thing that European Central Bank can agree upon is they'd rather give away their exports for nothing than raise living standards to the working class. So the one thing that holds the European countries together is the class war. England is plunging because it's a satellite of the dollar. Nobody knows, has a clue as to what to do. And every last time our panel was together was last month in London, and I was off to Malaysia. The first thing they did in Kuala Lumpur was take me to the harbor, and there were all these ships with nowhere to go, empty ships. And they showed me all of the shipping charts for all over the world. Every chart you look at has hit a vertical plunge. It's like hitting a wall, literally. It goes straight down. Almost every chart goes going straight down. Nobody can see where it ends. This is not a cyclical, a business cycle downturn. This is a real depression, and we've hit a debt wall, and nobody I know on the left or right can see any way out.
Okay, actually, I cheated him out of 2 minutes, and I just, because I gave him the wrong note, but we're going to let Michael come back during the question answer time. We're going to now, on that depressing note, turn to Hillel Tikton, and he's going to talk about the inherent instability of capitalism and four reasons why capitalism is at a turning point.
Thank you. Well, I completely agree with what Michael has just said. There is no way out. The question is whether or how capitalism will survive. There's no question that it will survive, but not because of the system in itself, as it were. If there were an opponent, it would not have survived. There is no working class party to take power. That is absolutely obvious, so I don't have to go any further and make a fool of myself by saying capitalism comes to an end in 6 months. As a couple of friends of mine, one from Greece and one from France, taking part in whatever they're taking part in, they're extremely optimistic, and they're talking of months. Obviously, that is not the case. Having said that, I can go to the next point. I completely agree with Michael. I can't see a way out. And what's more, I don't think the capitalist class can see a way out, and they know that they cannot see a way out. There isn't an objective way out. So what are we talking about here? Michael rightly pointed to the tremendous difficulty at the present time of capital to find where to invest. Now, that is the issue. But it's not just now. That has been true ever since they switched to the strategy of finance capital in the late 70s. Since then, we've had a huge asset inflation. We all know about that. It has now, to a degree, come to an end. But why do you have an asset inflation? Why didn't you have a boom? As we know, between 79 and 95, the rate of growth was very low. There was a short blip in which it rose and went down again. So a low rate of growth. They weren't able to invest, in other words. Or they were investing, but to a limited degree. We know that. We also know that the car industry, for instance, and of course not the only industry, is in tremendous trouble. And it's not because General Motors is hopeless. It may well be hopeless. But it's a worldwide overcapacity. We know that. And that's why I agree, again, with the first speaker, that the downturn, or depression as I'd call it, did not begin in finance. And he correctly pointed out that depression begins and has historically begun that way. The question then is, what is it? I can't say I agree with Jack, I agree with Michael rather, that it is a depression. Why? Because I don't think we should define it by numbers. After all, this would have been a worse depression. We would have had a worse depression if governments had not intervened. it is already, in statistical terms, worse in Great Britain. Now, that's a statistical freak, but that is the case. So it's quite difficult, in fact, to make that case, I think. One can, of course, do it if you want to do that. But I think in Marxist terms, what one would do is rather look at the causation. It's, of course, not just Marxist who define a downturn in causative terms. But that is the obvious thing to do, and it's quite clear that the cause for this downturn, which really is a form of continuation of what happened after March 2000, has to do with investment, with what we've just been talking about, accumulation. Whereas the previous ones, although there was some relation to it, had much more to do with governments deliberately deflating the economy, or in other words, had to do with inflation, or you put it in straight terms, with rising wages or potentially rising wages. In other words, they had to do with forms of control. Now, again, that's not a particularly Marxist argument either, because in March 2000, the Economist then pointed out the obvious fact that 99% of economists hadn't predicted it, as, of course, in this case as well. But they said this is the first investment downturn, and that was true. And that is the point. That is why it is a depression. That is why it is similar to what happened in 1929 onwards. In other respects, or in many respects, it may not be similar. But in that respect, it is. And it's potentially, if not for the high level of government intervention, very much worse than what would have happened in 1929. Well, we can see it with some simple statistics as well, in case you think I'm doing the usual left-wing thing of dreaming things up. The one bank in the world, UBS, which of course has been in enormous trouble, had in June last year 3.2 trillion Swiss francs in assets under management. In other words, money deposited there by the rich of the world. That's just one bank. And if you just think about it, it's actually more than the entire external surplus of China. Many bourgeois economists keep talking about fact that there are imbalances between different parts of the world economy. In fact, if you start to add up the total assets held by the wealthy, they could deal with it themselves. The question is then, if you have that kind of level of wealth under management, to which you have to add, of course, all the other forms which the rich use to increase their income. If you have all that, where do you invest it? If you don't want a boom. And that is the issue. Why don't I want a boom? I think that's been answered in different ways. But it does seem to me that that is the heritage, in a sense, of 1968. 1968 didn't go anywhere in terms of the working class. But it did teach the ruling class that they were in trouble. Why? Because in the end, capitalism cannot run with full employment. It cannot run where the fetishism of the commodity doesn't apply. It has to restore the market, as it were. It has to have high levels or relatively high levels of unemployment to control the working class. And that's effectively what they switched to. It was much better for the capitalist class to have a low rate of growth than to be directly threatened. And it does appear as if they've learned that lesson for life. They are not going to repeat it. They are not going to fund the economies to the point that there is a boom. That will simply not happen. Now, one could say, well, they could get out of it by doing that. Well, they could, but they won't do it because the result for them could be far worse than if they didn't do it. At least they would delay the overthrow of capitalism. And if you look at it historically, delay is a crucial method of preventing socialism coming about. The more sensible capitalists do realize that they are an outdated species, but they'd rather remain an outdated species. And one way to do that is simply to find forms of delay. So, putting it another way, capitalism is in decline. What is decline? It means that the forms of mediation, whereby the contradictions of capitalism are held at bay, are becoming progressively more difficult to apply. Now, what have been these forms? They aren't very nice when one looks through them. War, imperialism, Stalinism, the Cold War, and the one which wasn't, the welfare state, which they are not prepared to continue with or have been running down. Those have been historically the forms by which they were able to contain the threat to capitalism itself or have allowed the system to continue. Brutal forms with the exception of the welfare state, and the welfare state often enough is run brutally. It's been highly successful. The final one, which is more of a strategy, has been finance capital, of which we are really talking and have been talking. That was an attempt to reintroduce unemployment, reserve army of labor, and the ideological and controlling forms of commodity fascism. It's now been exploded. One has to ask, well, they have this wealth, okay. Well, so what are they going to invest in? If they rule out the idea of a reasonable rate of growth or a high rate of growth or whatever, some rate of growth of industry, where are we? It's hard to see. It's very hard to see. One has to ask the question too, why on earth is the Republican Party opposing something which you would have thought was in their interest? Why is the Conservative Party in Britain doing the same thing? What difference does it make if they pump more money in when all it is doing at one level is filling the hole which has emerged? As Sam Britton, the Financial Times, pointed out, when you're in a hole, you don't think about what it's going to be like once you get out of the hole. In any case, you know very well that the amount of money pumped in, to a large extent, can be pumped out again. So why are they so worried? Why are they fighting like dogs, in fact? Why has it become a big issue? And you could say in the European Union that the reason is they want to keep the euro. But wouldn't they keep the euro anyway? Couldn't they try and do it some other way? Or maybe they'll just lose the euro anyway. It's not very clear what's happening there. It's certainly in trouble. There may be some reason somebody knows about, but it does seem to me, it goes back to what I've just said, that in the end, they want to control the working class, perhaps even teach it a lesson. Let creative destruction rip. I think they're quite conscious of what they're doing. They want to establish control once and for all, rather than face a potential threat. I think that's what lies behind it. The idea of inflation is just nonsense. It's such utter rubbish, it's difficult to believe that anybody believes it. The idea that today, that because you put the money in now, sometime in the future you're going to get a terrible inflation. Or the absolute absurdity of saying that everybody will now owe some huge sum for the rest of their lives. That's clear nonsense. So it is much more a fundamental aspect of class politics which is showing itself in this really obscure way. I think that's why we have to actually see it. So what we find, therefore, is that we've ended up with a situation where finance capital, which worked so well, can no longer function in the same way. What is finance capital? Well, Hilfening defines in the first instance as abstract capital. I think that is fair enough. Or you can define it, which I would, together with the statement that it's abstract capital, that it is financial capital become dominant. So the issue actually is, can the financial section of capital remain dominant? Once you pose the question, it looks odd that you pose it. How can it remain dominant under these circumstances? It's hard to see. It's hard to see them continue in this form. Quite obviously, the $596 trillion of over-the-counter derivatives can't be maintained. It's hard to see them not allowing it to be reconstituted in some way or simply vanishing, as it were. One would have to ask why it came into being in the first place, and the answer there does seem to me is that since there was nowhere else to invest, they began to invest in themselves, as if money can make money. Obviously, to any Marxist, one would say, money cannot make money, it's absolute nonsense. Though if you put it to many people, they won't understand what you're talking about. Nonetheless, that is the case. So since money cannot make money, it's obvious that what came into being, growing as it did from 2001 to 2007 by this enormous rate of growth, in which it grew by 3 times, I think, in case of the total derivatives, and by 60 times in terms of credit default swaps. It's obvious that it's very much like a pyramid scheme, and it's therefore absolutely obvious that that in itself would have to explode. But then you have to ask, well, okay, they were doing it because they couldn't find anywhere else to go. But why didn't the government do anything? Was Greenspan sleeping on the job? I don't think so. I think they should give him a medal. He extended, effectively, the period before the explosion. I think he saw the instability of capitalism. He saw the instability of the time, and for that reason wouldn't raise the interest rates. I think it's absolutely correct from his own point of view, from their point of view. Had he done so, we would have had the same downturn, not in the same form, and he didn't want that. So in a sense, I don't go along with a bubble theory. A bubble theory is a very superficial way of looking at it. It's not really a bubble at all. It's a form of extending a period of extraction of surplus value longer than it might otherwise have continued. It exploded because it had to explode because nothing by, else that could have happened. So we, again, came back to the point. Can capitalism survive? Well, since there is no competitor, there is no working class to take power, the answer at the moment is yes. But how long will that be the case? And I think we have to say the struggles taking place now in France and Greece are just the beginning. We all recognize the IMF says the upturn will be weak. You have to ask, is that an upturn? Will it not be similar to the Great Depression in the upturns and downturns? I think we have to say that is bound to be the case. So I would say we have to be optimistic. Capitalism won't come to an end in 6 months. But it's now in the gravest trouble it has been. And it's in that trouble because the mediations which existed before are no longer there. Most particularly, the Cold War isn't there. And the control over the working class provided by Stalinism is no longer there. That is the most important. So we can have every optimism, even if capitalism will not be overthrown tomorrow, that its day is done. Thank you.